Today, of course, as every Wednesday in the 3 o'clock hour, it's Pentagon Solutions, a deep dive into issues that leaders inside the Pentagon are dealing with, and hearing solutions from people both inside and outside the building today. Highlights from a conversation at the Brookings Institution yesterday called Dissecting the Pentagon Strategic Choices and Management Review. The skimmer, of course, a popular topic of conversation around town. Speakers at this event, Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow for foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, and Mackenzie Eaglin, a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. The moderators, Marvin Kalb, a non-resident senior fellow for foreign policy at Brookings. They are looking at the details of the, as I mentioned, the Strategic Choices and Management Review. They are looking at the preliminary work on the Quadrennial Defense Review and DOD's latest thoughts about how it will deal with sequestration, not just this year, but moving forward. The first highlight is an introduction from Mackenzie Eaglin, and she says it's important to remember that sequestration is not the starting point.
So much in Washington feels like we're always starting at square one, but sequestration is the fourth year of defense budget cuts. This drawdown has been well underway. We peaked our defense spending in 2010, and there were a series of capability, capacity, and real budget cuts ever since. And so there's been almost roughly $1 trillion taken out of current or planned or future DOD spending in the last 4 years. Before sequestration. That's why this is tough. That's why you hear the chiefs constantly banging the drum. That's why you hear the secretary and the deputy secretary talk endlessly about how damaging sequestration is. This is not the first dollar of defense cuts, nor is it the first capability or capacity that's being unwound as part of this process. And so a lot of the things that I think we'll talk about this morning, unfortunately, are overdue. So many of the choices that the Pentagon has recently laid out are things I think that should have been under consideration 4 years ago. It's not to say that a lot of the defense cuts that started under President Obama and then Secretary of Defense Robert Gates weren't of value or utility in certain cases. This is not their first efficiency drill at DOD. But there was a lot of things done rightly and wrongly as part of those previous years. But I'm not so sure the lessons learned have sunk in. And so what we have now is a Defense Department and a Congress, a Washington, I guess you could say, that continues to have to go back to the same pots of money and the same priorities for DOD every year as part of the defense drawdown, because we're doing it on an annual basis. We're doing it piecemeal. It's chipping away at the margins defense cuts as opposed to big term, big picture, strategic planning, thinking about this, if we really do have to live with this, how do we handle it for 10 years and work backwards? And instead, we see what we saw in 2013, which is half a year or so into the fiscal year, we're going to start to talk about serious change and serious planning. And I certainly don't think that's any help to the $500 billion tab that's already on the table.
Mike, pick it up, please.
Yeah, thanks, Marvin. What I would say is, and again, it's been very well framed, some of the additional budget cuts that are now being considered I think are okay. And Mackenzie and I don't have the exact same view. I don't want to suggest that everything I say that she would endorse necessarily. We do think that there is room for efficiencies. And some of them are probably, if you can actually accomplish them, if you can get the Congress to authorize them, if you can actually implement them the way people think you can probably, let's say, reform information technology systems at a massive organization like the Department of Defense, they're worth doing. You know, and in the briefing that we heard last week from Secretary Hagel and his team, which developed some of the ideas that were also expressed by Deputy Secretary Carter in his congressional testimony that everybody can read on the web, we saw an estimate that perhaps $40 billion could be saved over 10 years from new efficiencies. And that's on top of the other efficiencies that were already identified as part of previous budget-cutting reviews, like additional base closures, although it's worth pointing out that Congress has not yet authorized many of those previous efficiencies. So if anything, we're even deeper in the hole than we thought, because even to get to previous levels of plan cuts, we're now going to have to either persuade Congress to change its mind and go ahead and authorize things like base closures, or find other ways to save comparable amounts of money. But let's say that base closures, for example, are authorized. Some of these efficiencies could save somewhere around $40 billion over 10 years. And every time you ask the Pentagon to try harder and go look deeper, they're probably going to find another $5 or $10 billion here or there. And so I would say that on balance, there's never going to be the end of any and all possible cuts. Is that me? No. That's good. It's okay that it's you. I just didn't want it to be me.
President, but I'm not answering.
Right, exactly. So $40 billion. Let's say we can do that. Then there's another examination of possible savings, which McKenzie and I wrote about in this Wall Street Journal op-ed 10 days ago. And they have to do with things like reductions in certain elements of military compensation, or at least reductions in the growth. Now, these are not easy, and they're not inherently desirable. I think all of us would agree that we've asked so much of our men and women in uniform that the idea that we should cut their compensation is not really a proper phrasing. We would, if anything, like to make sure that every possible benefit that can be proposed that they receive. Certainly wounded warriors, certainly the families of deployed soldiers, certainly troops leaving the force and trying to get a GI Bill so they can transition to the private sector. All these people deserve compensation that's not in any way hindered or compromised. But there are certain ways in which military benefits have not always been modified or streamlined to accommodate the new ways in which we live. Example would be the prevalence still of commissaries, which, you know, exist in many towns that have plenty of Walmarts and other such stores. And there are other ways in which you could make compensation reforms. And they're not trivially easy. I would not call them efficiencies. They are actually cutting back on the compensation, or at least the rate of growth of compensation, for our volunteer force that's done so much on behalf of all the rest of us over these last 12 years and before. And if you add up all those savings, which are more or less along the lines of what I would agree with, and similar to the kinds of ideas McKenzie and I had in our op-ed, that's another $80 billion, $85 billion in savings. So if you add up those two chunks of money, we're up to about $125 billion in additional 10-year savings out of the $500 billion that could be required by sequestration. The good news is that $125 billion is almost the amount the president's proposing to save over his 10-year latest budget plan. So we don't have to make a lot of cuts into military muscle, into force structure or weapons modernization. There's room for some cutting. And in my recent book, Healing the Wounded Giant, I wound up advocating about $200 billion in 10-year savings because I was prepared to recommend certain specific changes in certain weapons programs. We're all going to have somewhat different takes on what's the right number of Army divisions or brigades, how many Joint Strike Fighters we should purchase. My own take was that we could save, in addition to this $125 billion or so from efficiencies and compensation reforms, maybe another $75 to $100 billion from cutting muscle. And the Pentagon seems to have arrived in a different place, or excuse me, in a similar place insofar as it goes, but then it had to keep going.
That's Michael O'Hanlon. He's a senior fellow on foreign policy at the Brookings Institution, appearing yesterday with Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute in an event at Brookings. You're hearing it on Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. More of this event in just a minute, dissecting the Pentagon's Strategic Choices and Management Review. This is In Depth with Francis Rose.
Government contractors are helping federal employees across the country who are losing pay to furloughs. If your organization is asking, how can we help? The Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund, FEA, offers no-interest loans to feds in need. Loans are made only for necessities like rent, mortgage, or utilities. A recent $25,000 donation by a contractor extended loans by an entire week. Your company can help keep the lights on or ensure a federal family continues to have a roof over its head. Help feds in need today. Go to feea.org/corporate-support.
The Advanced Alliance Solutions Team, led by Technical and Management Resources, Inc., is a GSA Alliance small business contract holder. Here's President and CEO Linda Carr.
The Advanced Alliance Solutions Team consists of seven IT firms. Collectively, our core competencies cover all of the functional areas of the Alliant contract and supports agencies' enterprise IT requirements. For potential small business teaming opportunities, please contact us at advancedalliant.com.
To learn more, visit advancedalliant.com.
Hi, I'm Hugh Scott, a retired Navy hospital corpsman and nurse. For over 27 years, I took care of the wounded, but in 2010, I became the patient. All of a sudden, VA's patient portal, My Healthy Vet, became my online safety net. I rely on My Healthy Vet for continuity of care, to manage my health records, and ease my anxiety as a cancer patient. Having information available to me 24/7 on VA's My Healthy Vet helps me feel more in control. With My Healthy Vet, I can communicate with my doctors using secure messaging, view my VA lab results, and even see my VA clinical notes. It's proven. More and more veterans are using My Healthy Vet and getting the upgraded account to do more online. Veterans want this information. It's your care. It's your life. My Healthy Vet is celebrating 10 years of online access. If you're not online, do like I did and enroll today at www.myhealth.va.gov.
On October 4th, the USO of Metropolitan Washington hosts its Star-Studded Stars and Stripes fundraiser at the Sheraton Pentagon City Hotel. Mingle with top government contracting executives, celebrity supporters, and our nation's heroes. Nosh on great food and bid on amazing auction items, all for a great cause. Join as USO Metro announces its 2013 Circle of Stars, honoring top corporate donors for the year. This premier business-to-business networking event helps to fund vital support services for local troops and their families, including programs for wounded warriors and caregivers, children with deployed parents, emergency housing and food assistance, and many other critical programs. USO Metro's Stars and Stripes is presented by AT Solutions. Top sponsors include Boeing, Maryland Live Casino, CenturyLink, Sierra Nevada Corp., and many more. Individual tickets and corporate sponsorships are still available. To learn more, visit WTOP.com. Search charities.
Agencies are collecting data on their data security experts. I'm Emily Kopp. On Thursday's Federal Drive, the Office of Personnel Management's Sydney Smith Heimbrock explains why the government is building a data bank of cybersecurity employees. And would the Pentagon ever kill its most expensive weapons program? Maybe. It starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Today on Pentagon Solutions, highlights of an event called Dissecting the Pentagon Strategic Choices and Management Review at the Brookings Institution yesterday. Michael O'Hanlon of Brookings and Mackenzie Eaglin of AEI, the speakers at this event, Marvin Kalb of Brookings, the moderator. And more in this highlight from Michael O'Hanlon. He says his recommendations on efficiencies, compensation reforms, force reductions would save about $200 billion. He says the Defense Department took similar savings and looked at even deeper cuts throughout the skimmer.
And this is not a criticism of Secretary Hagel or Deputy Secretary Carter, because this recent review, the Strategic Choices and Management Review, or SCIMR, as it's called, or SCAMR, as it's sometimes derisively called by people who don't like the whole idea of cutting yet again from the Pentagon budget. The idea here was we're going to have to look for ways to save this $500 billion because sequestration currently is the law of the land, and it really may happen. And so above and beyond the kinds of changes I've already mentioned, the $40 billion in efficiencies, the $85 billion in compensation reform, and then some modest tweaks, perhaps, to capability. The skimmer did a couple of things that I really don't like. And I'm not sure its authors like it very much either, but they had to put these ideas on the table. And one of them is to downsize the U.S. Army quite a bit more than is already being planned. And I'm just going to mention this in my opening comment and then wait for other discussion topics later on. But let me just give you a sense of what's now being considered for the U.S. Army. The U.S. Army right now is just over 500,000 active duty soldiers. It had grown up to about 560,000 during the peak of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Of course, we also mobilized some reservists and National Guardsmen and women, so we had maybe another 100,000 on top of that 560. All of these numbers are, by the way, quite modest compared to the 1980s, the Cold War. We had 800,000 some forces in the U.S. Army alone in the active force in the 1980s. We had had much larger U.S. Army totals, of course, during Korea, Vietnam, not to mention World War II. So being down around 560,000, it was a growth from the Clinton years and from Secretary Rumsfeld's early thinking. All of that was in the 475,000 range, more or less. But it was not huge, and it did not reverse the cuts that were made at the end of the Cold War. Now we're already planning to go down basically to where Clinton and early Bush had been. The Army was headed previously to go back to 490,000 active duty troops. But the skimmer is envisioning reductions of down to maybe 420,000 or perhaps even lower if sequestration hits in its entirety and many of the cuts are taken out of the U.S. Army. I think this is a bad idea. In fact, the only place I have a disagreement with the administration is they suggested that this kind of a cutback to the Army is not necessarily a bad idea because it complies with the president's own strategic guidance given last year at the Pentagon, the so-called Defense Strategic Guidance document of January 2012, which said we don't want to do these big insurgency or counterinsurgency missions anymore. We've had enough. Iraq and Afghanistan have been frustrating and slow. Let's wash our hands of this kind of stuff. Well, you know, that's the exact sentiment we had after Vietnam. For similar reasons, and yet that sentiment, when taken to an excess, leaves you unprepared for the next time you might have to do a counterinsurgency when you like, whether you like it or not. There's the old Bolshevik saying, you may not have an interest in war, but it may have an interest in you. We may not have an interest anymore in counterinsurgency, but what happens when not just Syria stays mired in the mess that it's in now, but this infects more of the broader region, even Lebanon and Jordan? Or what happens when India and Pakistan come to the verge of nuclear war over Kashmir, and then the only way out of this potential escalation might seem an international force to sort of manage a trusteeship for Kashmir for some period of time. I could go on with hypothetical examples. They're going to sound a little crazy to you now, but they're going to sound about as crazy as it would have sounded in 2000 if I had mentioned Afghanistan as the source of a 9/11 attack. In other words, you can't always anticipate where war might spring up, and I haven't even mentioned Korea. So, bottom line, we have a lot more to discuss. The kinds of cuts to the U.S. Army being intended, or at least being considered now, within the skimmer process, I think are highly imprudent and leave us sort of catching on to the latest fad in warfare. We're tired of counterinsurgency, so let's just pretend that we can decide here in Washington we're never going to do it again. We've made that kind of mistake before as a country. We shouldn't make it now.
That's Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. You can hear more from the Brookings discussion dissecting the Pentagon Strategic Choices and Management Review in just a moment on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
At BAE Systems, we realize it's critical that our armed forces can get the job done, even when budgets are tight. That's why our engineers created the technology to transform an unguided munition into a precision laser-guided rocket, the perfect low-cost surgical strike solution. Knowing our work makes a difference inspires us every day, so we'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
Legal mistakes can be costly. Whether it's a business contract or dispute, a family situation or property, Power of Attorney covers all that and more. This Saturday at 10 a.m., join the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman and learn the latest legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. Power of Attorney is sponsored by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm taking pride in working together with our clients, fully invested in their success. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
This week's Experts in Health topic is heat-related illnesses, featuring Dr. Ann Hellerstein, a pediatrician with the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, who practices at Kaiser Permanente's Gaithersburg Medical Center.
In the summer, when your child is exercising or spending time in the sun, it's important to be aware of heat-related illnesses. Exercising during hot weather and overdressing increase your child's risk. Chills, dark-colored urine, dizziness, dry mouth, headaches, thirst, and weakness are common signs of heat-related illness in children. To prevent this, make sure your child drinks plenty of water before, during, and after being active, and takes a hydration break every 20 minutes. Also, when temperatures hit over 100 degrees, it's important to encourage your child to play indoors rather than outside.
Dr. Hellerstein was recently recognized as a top doctor in Washingtonian Magazine and was a 2012 Washington Post Super Doctor. For more information, visit kp.org/midatlantic and click Meet Our Doctors.
When faced with opportunities and challenges, it's important to have a reliable information technology partner on your side. Make a confident choice with GovConnection. Our extensive experience serving the federal marketplace ensures we can identify and apply the right purchasing vehicles to equip your organization with the right tools to accomplish your mission. The IT marketplace is full of companies who claim to be different. Choose GovConnection. Call 800-800-0019. Sponsored by HP Enterprise Group. It's time to build a better enterprise.
Four for Life. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, want to live? Researchers know of four things people can do that could keep the Reaper at bay. They saw it in data on 6,200 men and women who were followed for an average of about 7.5 years. At Johns Hopkins Ciccarone Center for Prevention of Heart Disease, Haytham Ahmed says the most important is not smoking. The others are staying physically active, eating a Mediterranean-style diet with fruit, nuts, whole grains, fish, and olive oil, and keeping a normal weight. Ahmed says people who did all four did best, but
the more healthy behaviors you adopted, the better you did over many years. And by better, I mean cardiovascular disease and death.
The study in the American Journal of Epidemiology was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthSpeed is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Each day, over 49 million Americans live in households that experience hunger, including 17 million children. Johnson's Florist and Garden Centers want to help. They're asking gardeners in the Washington area to plant extra this growing season, and at harvest time, bring that extra to one of their stores in D.C., Kensington, and Olney, Maryland. All donations will go to a local organization that feeds the hungry. Visit johnsonsflorist.com to learn more about the Plant a Row for the Hungry initiative. johnsonsflorist.com.
Now your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour. The White House is considering 8 ideas to get industry to adopt the National Institute of Standards and Technology's cybersecurity framework called for in President Obama's 2013 executive order. Suggestions came from the Commerce, Homeland Security, and Treasury departments. The framework and voluntary program are still under development, but the recommendations incorporate feedback from public and private stakeholders through DHS-led partnerships. NIST continues to hold listening sessions to get feedback. Find more at federalnewsradio.com. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com.
Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Today on Pentagon Solutions, you're hearing highlights of an event yesterday at the Brookings Institution called Dissecting the Pentagon's Strategic Choices and Management Review. Speakers, Michael O'Hanlon of Brookings and Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute. The moderators, Marvin Kalb of Brookings. And in this highlight, some questions and answers for the speakers on the panel. The moderator, Mr. Kalb, starts it off with a simple yes or no question.
Do you think by the end of this year, Congress will have acted on sequestration specifically for the military and pulled it out of the law? What do you think?
No. Or they may have acted, but they'll have acted separately in each chamber, and it will not be reconciled. There won't be any change to the law.
So that we can realistically look forward to the implementation of sequestration at the Pentagon. Mike?
I fear Mackenzie may be right, but there is still the chance. If you look at the 2014 budget, and I'll be quick, I promise, but the cuts that would be required by sequestration are so harsh for that year, and there's no way to phase them in realistically. It's even a worse debacle than the notion of sequestration over the 10-year time horizon. The pain that occurs to the force in that year dwarfs even what we're going through this summer, and it compounds what we're going through this summer when almost half the Air Force isn't flying, for example, when equipment queues are piling up at these depots, and we're not fixing the stuff that we need to keep safe for our forces. So I think Congress may ultimately say the $52 billion in 2014 defense cuts that sequestration would require need to be softened a little, and maybe they add the cuts to the back end or something. In other words, they don't do anything that's fundamentally changing the basic logic of sequestration, but they soften the blow in 2014. That's possible just because the specter of sequestration next year is so horrible for the armed forces.
If that be the case, we're still working with the reality of very massive cuts. And, Mike, you have given us a little bit of a hint about the practical effect that that's going to have on the military. But a military exists to implement, to fulfill the desires, the strategic aims of the country. Now, as I mentioned earlier, we had lived in this country for a long time with the belief that we could fight two wars at the same time. I assume that we mean, if you go back 10 years, Iraq and Afghanistan at the same time. That, of course, did not take into account, as you were implying a moment ago, that there could be an outbreak of hostility in Korea, which would involve the United States militarily. So if we look at the strategy now, and we look at the amount of money that is going to be available to be spent, what do you think, Mackenzie, will be the effect on the strategy itself? What would you recommend to the president, for example, and he does listen to Republicans, so it's okay. But what would you recommend to the president that he begin to consider as a change in the strategic aims of the U.S. to conform to the economic reality?
Of course, I wouldn't want to advocate that, right? I'm already disappointed that the Defense Department has officially moved on from the longstanding two-war construct. This has been underway for more than the last couple of years. So
moved on in the sense of beginning to change.
Correct, meaning where our contingency planning and our war planning are formally changing quietly to move away from the two-war capability, at least the two-war simultaneous capability, and certainly any operation for any length of time.
So where are we going now?
Well, the department is sticking by its January guidance, as Michael mentioned, the Defense Strategic Guidance issued last January, which is, you know, we all, the rest of us call it the pivot or rebalance to Asia. It's basically an increased emphasis on Asia and trying to hold the line in the Middle East for the most part. But it is largely, regardless of what Vice President Biden says, it is at the expense of capability and capacity in other regions of the world because the military is shrinking and the budgets are falling too quickly. They don't have a choice. So, for example, the CNO just said we don't have a single ship in Southern Command. So you can't say it's not zero-sum. That's the unfortunate reality of the pivot, although it's a relatively sound strategy. The QDR independent panel called for a similar
the
type.
The what panel?
The QDR independent panel in 2010, which was the stress test to the Obama's first defense strategy that year. And they basically called for a pivot before the Obama administration. Some would argue even the Bush administration started this. It's a sound strategy so long as it's not zero sum. But the problem is I don't see any scenario where the department can continue to hew to it, even though I know that's the predisposition at the Pentagon, is to hew to the strategic guidance.
Meaning what? Two wars at the same time?
An emphasis on Asia and a toehold in the Middle East, for lack of a better...
So that's both?
Correct.
Okay, and what you're saying is that economically we're not going to be able to do that.
They're already moving away from it in realistic terms. But the predisposition is to not break the strategy. And we also heard this reiterated at the Pentagon last week. You know, the management reviews, budget scenarios were... implement the president's budget in 2014, no sequester as is, and it fulfills the guidance, which in and of itself is questionable. I don't know that it ever was fully resourced. A quarter trillion in defense budget cuts, like the Senate budget, for example, proposal by Senator Patty Murray, larger than the president's in this latest latest budget process, that would bend the strategy, and then the full sequester would break it, where they literally would throw it out and start all over from January. Unfortunately, based on the double and triple whammy holes that Michael's referencing, that we're not just talking sequester dollars anymore. We're talking efficiencies that won't be realized that compiled on as a tab in addition to sequester. And we're talking about readiness holes that the department is plugging. That's also its own tab and something we should talk about later. All of these things combined means that any scenario is at a minimum bending the strategy, if not breaking it. And I actually, like I said, I think it's a sound one, but I don't know realistically how you keep it.
That is Mackenzie Eaglin, a resident fellow at the Enterprise Institute, speaking at an event hosted by the Brookings Institution yesterday. And you also heard Michael O'Hanlon of Brookings and Marvin Kalb moderating the event. Marvin Kalb is a senior fellow for foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. More from this discussion in a minute as they look at the strategic choices review that the Pentagon released last week, the Strategic Choices and Management Review, the Skimmer, and more next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The mission of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Program Support Center. What is shared services and how does HHS's Program Support Center manage the business of government? How is PSC using technology to streamline operations, increase efficiencies, and reduce costs? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and so much more with Paul Bartley, Deputy Assistant Secretary for Program Support at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and Director of its Program Support Center.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and MetLife. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m.
Steve Richardson saved the life of a kidnapped 5-year-old boy. William Baruchy helped discover Earth-like planets 1,200 light-years away. And Dave Brumell has been called the Steve Jobs of the Social Security Administration. These individuals are among the 31 federal employees named finalists for this year's Service to America medals. The awards honor feds advancing the health, safety, and well-being of Americans. Hear interviews with each of the nominees and learn more about their work at federalnewsradio.com. Search Service to America.
Newsmakers, talk to Jared Serbu.
M.L. Mackey, the CEO and co-founder of Beacon Interactive Systems and vice chair of the National Defense Industrial Association Small Business Division.
When you as the vendor having a difficult time with uncertainty, but your customer is full of uncertainty. Our DoD customer saying, I have no idea if I can get it under contract by the end of the year when the funds go away. That level of uncertainty is just wreaking havoc across the industrial base.
Hear the entire interview online at federalnewsradio.com/Jared Serbu.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. You're listening to In Depth with Francis Rose. Pentagon Solutions today highlights from a panel discussion called Dissecting the Pentagon Strategic Choices and Management Review from yesterday at the Brookings Institution. Michael O'Hanlon of Brookings and Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, the panelists, the moderators, Marvin Kalb of Brookings, and in your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems afternoons at 40 minutes after the hour. More questions for Mackenzie and Michael both from Mr. Kalb, and he continues with a question about the strategic choices part of the skimmer.
Mike, you have written that you go from the two wars at the same time concept to one war plus two. And I assume by that you mean two smaller engagements. Could you spell that out for us? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, thank you, Mark. I think it's really good that you're focusing on the strategic choices before us as we think about different defense budget levels, because otherwise it just seems like moving around
a lot
ships
of numbers,
on a
right.
And there is obviously room for debate even within a given size military or defense budget, because it's not as if all wars come in the same cookie cutter size and shape as we know. But nonetheless, the basic logic, as you've been saying, is for a long time, we thought we'd maybe have to fight Iraq and North Korea at the same time. It turned out to be Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, you can debate whether we had to do them both, but we did do them both. And ultimately, our military was a little too small for, even though we had been trying to have the capacity for two at the same time, we were a little bit off in our calculations. And that's part of why Secretary Gates ultimately had to increase the size of the Army and Marine Corps in the last decade. Then, in the 2010 Quadrennial Defense Review that Mackenzie referred to a minute ago, the administration began to soften a little bit the requirement for that second war to be quite as definitive immediately. And in fact, there had been, this is a 20-year-old debate, if not more, in terms of whether these two wars have to be exactly simultaneous and both lead to the overthrow of the enemy government and the occupation of its territory, whether there's some room for the second one to be a little more gradual and a little less definitive in its war aims. But in 2010, President Obama started to move a little bit away from that robust rhetorical emphasis on two wars. And I think he was correct to do that because Saddam Hussein was gone. And even though Iraq is obviously still very turbulent, it's much less likely to be an overland invasion threat to its neighbors. Now, Iran's still there in the Middle East, obviously, but it's also relatively unlikely to be an invasion threat. It could be a lot of other kinds of threat to its neighbors, but probably not an invasion threat. So that was 2010. Then in 2012, in this famous defense strategic guidance that we're referring to, the January guidance, the administration softened a little further and talked about that second war perhaps not really needing to be thought of as an all-out war at all. Although there was still the notion that you might have to punish a second aggressor and maybe wait for the first war to be concluded before you could swing over and really deal with it properly. So, you know, there's some semantics here.
So it's like playing with reality.
A little bit. But still, I would have supported the logic through that point, because we did have to shift more of our focus towards the rise of China. Not that I expect war with China, but we have to worry about deterring China, and also towards Iran. And these are both unlikely to be classic big land wars. They could be more maritime or air, cyber, special forces-oriented conflicts. So softening the sort of ground war requirement from a two-war to a one-and-a-half capability or something like that, I think was okay. But now what we're seeing with the strategic choices and management review and the sequestration specter that's motivating the whole thing is the possibility of going down to something like maybe a one war and nothing else. So maybe you can still do Korea, maybe, provided that your entire army is available for it. Unfortunately, that's often not how the world works. And we all know that our good friend Martin Indyk just left Brookings to go try to negotiate Palestinian-Israeli peace. In the relatively unlikely event that he succeeds, there could be an international implementation force backstopped by American troops to make that acceptable to the Israelis. That's one example. I alluded to a couple of others a minute ago. If we wind up, as President Obama has said he would do, preventing Iran from developing a nuclear weapon and have to use military power to do that, the idea that this is a one-off where we bomb, they hit one of our embassies someplace, and then we all call a truce and go back to life as normal, I think is pretty optimistic. And there's a decent chance that we're going to have to reinforce some of our allies in the Gulf with some American ground presence to remind Iran that we have an interest in the security of these countries. And so there are a number of scenarios. That's why I talk about one plus two. You better be able to do one all-out war, like Korea, heaven forbid, but also two simultaneous smaller missions. But they could be long-lasting, and hopefully they're multilateral. But they could be long-lasting. And that's where I come up with an army that, to me, should be around 450,000 active-duty soldiers. The skimmer process envisions an army that could be 400,000 or less, and I think that's too small.
Mackenzie, in your view, what is the part of the world that the United States military must be focused on more than any other?
In this moment, it's the Middle East. Strategically, you know, the Defense Department has to do both, right? They have to think about the world as it is in this very moment and reality, mm-hmm. and what is happening and things simmering and brewing and conflict breaking out and crises everywhere, and then think about 5 and 10 and 20 years. They really do need to do both, and that is the ambition of the pivot.
Presumably they are doing that.
They are.
Yeah, okay.
They are. So if you look at, for example, the budget request from last year and the reprogramming requests that have come to Capitol Hill, their focus and immediate concern is the Middle East, period. And that's exactly right.
The Middle East means what? Break that down. Because Mike spoke about Iran, but one could think about the Syria. One could think now about a building, huge problem in Egypt. There is everything going on in North Africa. What does the Middle East mean to us now? Where? What?
Well, what it means to us is probably debatable, meaning the proverbial us.
No, but I mean you military experts.
Well, so let me start out quickly to say, for DOD right now, it's the wolf closest to the sled, which is Iran. And looking at a lot of the capabilities and counter capabilities that might be required to deter, and if not, to deter conflict from breaking out or somebody miscalculating in some international waters or actually prevailing in some type of military effort, whether we're supporting someone else or undertaking our own.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, as you alluded to, there are many other things happening, and many of them also spill into North Africa with special forces and counterterror missions, mm-hmm. et cetera. But that's mm-hmm. certainly not what we're limited to. There's obviously ongoing planning for Syria and Egypt, as there should be. I don't know that there's That's just a sample.
That's Mackenzie Eaglin, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, with Brookings senior fellow Michael O'Hanlon answering questions from Marvin Kalb of the Brookings Institution at an event there yesterday. You can hear just a little bit more when we continue on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, coming right up.
Today's Human Capital Management Report brought to you by The Graduate School.
Federal employees are starting to feel the effects of furloughs in their wallets. In July, a record number of feds applied for furlough-related assistance from FEA, the Federal Employee Education and Assistance Fund. The organization gave out 148 loans totaling $87,000. FEA loans are interest-free, and any Fed who has worked for the government for 1 year is eligible. Find more information on applying for loans or learn how you can donate to FEA at federalnewsradio.com. Search furlough loans.
Need to do more with less? Here's how to get more for less. The best value for your training dollars. Contact Graduate School USA, ranked the most affordable and overall best choice for federal training. They offer hundreds of top quality courses, including customized programs taught right at your location, online, or in Graduate School USA classrooms, conveniently located near L'Enfant Metro. Get more from your training budget. Visit graduateschool.edu. That's graduateschool.edu.
True innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
You can join State Department Federal Credit Union today and enjoy a $50 bonus, and that's just the beginning of your benefits. Take advantage of an SDFCU free checking account and earn rewards points just by using your debit card. That's right, rewards with your debit card. You'll have access to 29,000 ATMs, mobile deposit, and option to design your own card. Get your $50 bonus and rewards. Visit joinsdfcu.org. That's joinsdfcu.org.
SDFCU is federally insured by NCUA.
If you're not reading federalnewsradio.com, you're missing out on the most read website in the federal market, featuring federal news and information that affects you every day. Here's what readers are saying about federalnewsradio.com.
It's a one-stop shop on federal issues, the most comprehensive of all the websites.
The news content is timely and fresh.
Unbiased news and clear information that's easy to understand.
Make it your daily read for the news you need. federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. On Pentagon Solutions today, you're hearing highlights from a panel discussion called Dissecting the Pentagon Strategic Choices and Management Review at the Brookings Institution yesterday. Michael O'Hanlon of Brookings and Mackenzie Eaglin of AEI, the speakers on the panel, the moderators Marvin Kalb of Brookings. And in this highlight, some more questions from Mr. Kalb. He asks if their analysis of how the skimmer addresses emerging threats is based just on theoretical scenarios and maybe isn't a reflection of what's really going on in the world.
Think about it. You both have spoken of Iran. If the United States in the next year or two or three decides that it must take on Iran and its nuclear program, and Korea erupts, it's not a matter of a small operation. Korea is big time, and we already have 28,000 troops in South Korea. So the idea of 1 plus 2, the idea of whittling down 2, sounds to me as if it is not related to reality, and the United States has to be in a position, whether it's 2 or 1 plus 2, of taking on any combination of military challenges. But can the United States do that realistically in light of what is happening in the American economy, in light of what is happening in American politics, in light of the fact of sequestration? We are, at this particular point, having strategy being determined by people up on the Hill who may not have a clue as to what strategy is all about. Is that not right?
That's right.
The way I would, I'm glad you're framing these choices very starkly, because it is our national security after all, and we have to get away from a theoretical discussion and just throwing around numbers. And I'm, you know, I threw around numbers with my 1+2. But again, if you ask me why do we have to be able to do two smaller missions at the same time, I would say that's typically because that's the number we're doing. Now, Afghanistan's moving from a war to one of these kind of smaller missions. And the expectation is that we'll keep 10 to 15,000 U.S. troops there for a number of years, even after the mission formally ends next year. Middle East peace is President Obama's goal, rightly so. And I don't know what kind of U.S. force might be needed to help backstop it, but probably 1 to 2 brigades. The likelihood of war against Iran, I'd probably in the 30% range. I mean, a lot more than 5 or 10%. Hopefully not 50%. But if we do wind up in that kind of a strike, which we hope will be limited at first, we should remember from history, you don't get to always decide when wars end. You may get to decide sometimes when you start them. You don't usually get to decide exactly when they're over. And so the idea of having to shore up our defenses along the Persian Gulf states like Kuwait, Qatar, UAE, and Saudi Arabia, I think, is a pretty plausible notion. It might involve some ground forces. So when you think through the smaller missions, we're likely to do 2 and maybe even 3 at a time. And I haven't even talked about my preference, which would be for an ultimate Bosnia-style solution in Syria, where the U.S. deploys some forces there as part of a peace deal, not as an invasion, but as part of an ultimate peace deal, probably not this year. It's probably not within reach this year, but maybe in a year or two. So if anything, I've understated the requirement. And 450,000 troops in the active duty U.S. Army and roughly 160,000 to 170,000 in the U.S. Marine Corps, I think is a small economical way to design a ground force for the world that we're facing today. It's not throwing umpteen piles of cash at an already bloated Pentagon.
Okay. Now, Mackenzie, Mike earlier on talked about the Army and its effect. What about the Navy? What about the Air Force? Can you give us some sense of what, if these cuts take place, will happen to the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Air Force?
Sure. The consequences are pretty stark for both of these services and, of course, the Marine Corps as well. It was framed to us as part of the Pentagon presentation that the Marine Corps is one of our hedge presence forces globally. You know, they're out there ready to respond. Of course, that's leaving out the Air Force, which just evacuated personnel last night from U.S. Citizens from Yemen and other places. So we're forgetting the Air Force, but the Marine Corps does have that significant role. And when we talk Navy cuts, I'll include them as well. It's pretty consequential. Let me start with the Air Force, however, after discussing the Marine Corps briefly. The Air Force is the second biggest loser under these budget debates. They're not strategic, as you've already clearly outlined for the audience, and I think that's exactly why everyone's frustrated in Washington. This is not strategic driven, okay? And we can just say that up front. I don't think anybody disputes it anymore. The Army is getting a lot of attention, understandably and rightly so, and Michael is so eloquent in talking about why that's a problem. But the Secretary of Defense outlined in his remarks last week that he's going to change the so-called golden ratio of the service budget shares, the recently historical amounts that the services have received, a roughly one-third, one-third, one-third equation. And the implication there was that the Navy is the relative winner, but no one's a winner, right? Because everybody's coming down. It's about who's coming down less than the others. And the Army is the most significant and heavy bill payer, but the Air Force is a close second.
In what way?
So the emphasis in this briefing, anyway, is on tactical fighter forces and some lift forces, C-130 in particular. But there's certainly more that was not mentioned as part of the briefing. Retire a significant chunk, over half of our bomber force. Most of these are old, and this should be considered anyway. But when you need numbers, when you need bombers, and you really do need them, that could become a really worrisome outcome. So, you know, if you consider your Air Force, your service of depth, your hedging force, your swing force, your global force, for example, which I do, this is very concerning. These are the kinds of things you will give up. The Navy, and maybe Michael wants to talk a little bit more, aside from some of the Marine Corps cuts and the amphibious capabilities and others, and air power capabilities in the Marine Corps. So the Secretary talked about 2 to 3 carrier strike groups, which of course is not just a carrier and all of the people and aircraft on top of it, but all of the associated ships and capabilities.
2 or 3 cut down from where we are now.
Correct.
Which is what?
Technically, it's an 11 carrier force with a waiver of 1, so it's a 10 carrier force.
And we would
today.
Come down to 8. Yes. If the sequestration went through.
That's the prediction right now.
It's Mackenzie Eaglin, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. You also heard Michael O'Hanlon, a senior fellow at Brookings, answering questions from Marvin Kalb, who is a non-resident senior fellow for foreign policy at the Brookings Institution. Those three speaking at Brookings yesterday, and you can find out more about the event, find a video link at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later on this afternoon. Hour number 2 of In-Depth with Francis Rose is right around the corner, and you've been listening to Pentagon Solutions on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.